To the book of Ecclesiastes. We are going to try this evening to finish up our study through this book. We could take a lot more time, but I want to try to finish it tonight. I have thoroughly enjoyed studying through this. There are sermons that are like the one this morning that are easy in some ways to preach because it just flows from the text. There are some sermons that are a lot more difficult to preach, maybe because of the subject matter, maybe because of the depth of the lesson itself. But I always find that the easiest sermons to preach are the ones where you just look at the text and just go through and pull out the things that God has revealed there for us. And I always seem to enjoy those the most. And I hope in some ways that enjoyment is passed along to you all. I remember Brother Holly one time pointed out that there are no boring books of the Bible, only boring teachers. And sometimes I'm afraid I can be that boring teacher. Sometimes I don't feel like I get across the things that I intend to say. But I hope that all of us, as we look to God's Word, we find enjoyment wherever we are in the Scriptures. I appreciate James's reading tonight from Psalm 119. The whole Psalm is just filled with praise for God, but specifically for God's Word that He has given us. There are some books in the Bible that are a lot easier to understand, that may seem more relevant, that you could just turn and just pick everything off the page and understand it completely. And then there are other books, I think, perhaps like the book of Ecclesiastes, that are a little bit more of a challenge for us. We have to dig a little deeper. We have to think a bit more about what's being said. And it's a book that I have struggled with in the past. Not just one or two verses in the book, but quite a few that just look at and try to figure out, well, what's being said here. What am I supposed to learn from this? But last year, as I had an opportunity to study this with Brother Wes Brown, it was like there was a key handed to me, and that key just kind of unlocked the book. And I've recognized before that there are different perspectives in the book, but when you see that it really just boils down to these two perspectives, you've got the godly view versus the ungodly view. And everything that's in the book is going to fit into one of those two categories. And as you begin to look and try to figure out, well, what fits where, it makes it a lot easier. Now, there are still quite a few verses in the book that I don't know that I could tell you exactly that this is what Solomon had in mind, or that this is what the Lord had in mind when He inspired Solomon to write it. But overall, I feel a lot better about my understanding. And tonight we're going to look at a passage that I'll say I have taken it, I believe, in the wrong way in the past. And I think as we see the truths that are being revealed here, that maybe there'll be some others like me who, as we read through it, you'll have that little light bulb go off and you say, aha, I finally see it. I finally get what the Lord is trying to tell us here. So without further ado, I want to begin in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. I recognize we didn't finish up everything from 7 and 8, but I want to go ahead and start in 9. I think as we finish out the book, these last four chapters, if you then want to go back and study through chapters 7 and 8, I think the things there will come to light. I think you'll understand maybe better than you have in the past. But we want to start here in chapter 9, let's go ahead and read the first couple of verses there, 9:1. For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath as he who fears an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. This is a repeated refrain throughout the book, this idea that one event happens to all. It doesn't matter your status in life. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, wise or foolish. We are all going to die. That's a simple fact. It doesn't really matter whether you're looking from the godly perspective or the ungodly perspective. That's a fact that both sides will see. We are all going to die. But so often in the book, this view and this idea that all of this life is vain or vanity, it's empty, it's worthless, because in the end, we just all die and it doesn't matter what we've done in this life. Now, that is the ungodly view. The ungodly view sees that this is it. This is all we have. And so while we're here, you know, you strive to gain wisdom, you strive to gain material things, and you try to build yourself up, but at the end, what good has it accomplished in it? And so you see there in verse 3, it says, truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. And you can understand why that madness would form. They're just scurrying and they're trying as much as they can to get as much out of this life as is possible, because after this, it's over. And so you see the evil and the madness that comes from that type of mindset. But back up in verse 1, you notice he says that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. If we remember that, if we will understand that, then it will help us as we look to death. As we look to the end and see that we're all going to die, well, it makes a difference if we understand that our lives are in God's hands. He follows that by saying in verse 1 that people know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. And I don't believe this is necessarily talking about that they wouldn't know the love of God, that they wouldn't, but just as they're going to be treated by this world, you know, how their life is going to go, we can't always know. We're not going to know if people are going to love us or hate us. We're not going to know if they're going to receive us or reject us. But what we can know for certain is that if we are righteous and wise, then we are in God's hand. And regardless of what this life throws at us, regardless of how we are received by the people of this world, God is still in control. He's still in control of all the world, but more importantly, and maybe more personally, He's still in control of my life. So even in these first three verses, I think you have these two views. You've got the view of the godly and the ungodly. One who recognizes our life is in the hands of God, and one who says there is no God, and all is madness and evil and folly. Which leads us to verse 4. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. And I imagine that all of us at some point have expressed those words in some way. And we've expressed it in a way that, you know, that's a truth. You know, a living dog is better than a dead lion. Brother Brown told the story of a young preacher that he was talking to. This young preacher had the opportunity for Brother Irvin Lee to come and stay in his home while he was holding a meeting with that congregation. And I believe it was Brother Lee's birthday was going to take place during that meeting. And so when his birthday came, this younger preacher was talking to him. And I guess as Brother Lee was getting older at that point, you know, age brings sometimes difficulties and the thing. Well, the young preacher made the statement, well, you know, another year, even though getting older, he said, it beats the alternative, doesn't it? And The way the story was told, it was said that Brother Lee looked at him like a three-headed dog. I don't know how you look at a three-headed dog, but just with shock, I guess. So the man had said it at BC Alternative, and Brother Lee looks at him and says, "You mean the arms of Abraham or Abraham's bosom? That's the alternative you're saying that it be? Living here in this life with all of its sufferings and all of its problems, that's better than being in the bosom of Abraham?" And I remember as Wes was telling that story, it was just like a ton of bricks hit me. Like, boom, yeah. I've said dumb things like that before. I've probably quoted this verse to people and said, "Hey, you know, a living dog is better than a dead lion." No, it is not, brother. And I think sometimes we are quick to forget that. A living lion will always beat a dead or living dog. I got that backwards. A dead lion will always beat a living dog. We have an example of that in Scripture. We have a dead lion and a living dog. Their names were Jesus and Pilate. And you could substitute the name Pilate with almost anyone else in the world at that time. But you've got a lion of the tribe of Judah who is dead. I know he was raised from the dead. I know he ascended to the Father. But even while in the grave, while dead, would anybody argue that Pilate was better off than Jesus? No, we wouldn't argue that. And so when we talk about a saint, when we talk about a brother or sister who has passed from this life, I mean, we can mourn and we can sorrow, but not sorrow for them. We should never feel sorry for a brother or sister in Christ who has passed away. We feel sorry for ourselves, and we can mourn that loss. And I think even the book of Ecclesiastes tells us that that is the right thing to do. But it's not sorrow for the person who has passed. A lion, one who has lived their life for God, one who is honorable, one who is noble, one who has striven, not perfectly, but one who has striven to do the right things in this life, death is just the beginning. Death is where they begin to live life. It's where they begin to truly see God and know God for who He is. And those who are left behind, well, we need to strive to be that lion and look forward to the day that we can die and be with them. I could spend the rest of the time right here, but what we're going to notice through the rest of the book is that we're going to keep coming back to the same idea that it does matter. If we serve God in this life, if we have the wisdom that God's given us and we use it to His glory, then that will make all the difference in what comes next. Whether or not we can be that dead lion, whether or not we have the hope of that one who has lived his life with God in view. He comes down from verse 4, and he says, "For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten." Well, again, this is the ungodly view. Because we know for the godly, they're not forgotten. We know that they do know something. Even those who are wicked know something in their death, and we have that example given to us in Luke chapter 16, as we read of the rich man and Lazarus. That rich man fully well knows where he is, and he understands the torment he's facing. And as we see Lazarus there, he's aware, and he knows what's going on. So verse 5, don't take this as a truth. I think sometimes we look at verses in the Bible and say, "Well, the Bible says it." Well, the dead do know something. And that rich man, he wanted to send Lazarus back to warn his brethren because he knew that wasn't a place where he wanted his brothers to come. Well, the next line, the memory of them is forgotten. That can be true, but they'll never be forgotten by God. They'll never be forgotten in the afterlife. And the people here on earth may forget them. They may pass from our memories, but they will not be forgotten by God. Also, their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. And again, well, maybe that's true to an extent. I mentioned Brother Lee just now. And I tell you what, I think he has a lot of share still under the sun. This past week, I was reading a book, Good Homes in a Wicked World. And I learned a lot from that man. He's been dead for many years, but he still has an impact on those who are alive. So we can have a share in things done under the sun. As generations come after us and our children, our grandchildren, hopefully we will be remembered for the good that we've done, and our example may stand out to some as one to be followed. Hopefully that'd be the case. Another, what I'm trying to show is we can look at verses 5 and 6 and say, well, yeah, that sounds pretty true, but it's not true. It is true for one who says this is it. There is nothing past this life, but it's not true for those who are with God. Verse 7, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your words. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. I think here we flip to the other side of it. I think here we are going back to the view of the godly. One of the things that we've seen throughout the book is really the same statement made, eat, drink, and be merry, but in two different views. One view is, well, there is no God, and so just live it up while you're in this life. There's another view that says, well, there is a God. Enjoy what God has given you while you can. There are some things we're not going to be able to enjoy in the life to come. Look in verse 9. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun. All your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. There are some things that God has blessed us with that are limited to this life. We find out in Matthew chapter 22 that in heaven we will be neither married nor given in marriage. And so, to say in verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, well, this is all the time we're going to have. I remember Brother Waldron saying one time after Sister Waldron had passed away, we were in a Bible study, and he said, you know what I miss the most is just the ability to cherish her. And to hear him talk about it, I think we all cried. Right? They're grown men, we all cried because we just saw how much he loved her. But while he still loved her. It was obvious he still loved her. But that relationship was now gone. And it would not come back. He's not going to rejoin her in heaven as husband and wife. Jesus teaches us that. And we might scratch our head and wonder, well, why would God take that away from us? You know, maybe that's one thing we don't understand. Why would God, you know, keep that relationship? I don't have an answer for that. What I do have an answer for is, in heaven, God will only bless us more than what we've enjoyed in this life. And so whatever he has in store for us there, it's got to be better than what was here. And as much as we enjoy the relationships we have with our spouse, I know it would be better in heaven. But it is limited to this life. So make the most of it. Husbands, let's strive to be better husbands. Wives, strive to be better wives. While you have the time, while you have that relationship here in this life. Verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, including being that husband or wife, or whatever it is, because there is coming a time when we can't do any more with what God has blessed us with here. And so there are things which are limited to this life. Let's make the most of that. Yes, we're recognized death is coming for us. So let's use the blessings that God has given. We're going to come back to that when we get to chapter 11. Moving on here to verse 11, he says, I returned and saw under the sun. I think when he says, I returned, I think now we're returning back to that ungodly view. That the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. And again, we might be tempted to read verse 11 and say, well, that's true. You know, in fact, in the book of Jeremiah, we read something about the victories not to the strong or mighty, the wise, but it's God who would ultimately give victory to whom he chooses. And so we might read verse 11 and say, well, there's some truth there. I think we would all recognize that, yes, time and chance do happen. There are occasions when we find ourselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. This morning, Cindy was telling me that this was the one-year anniversary of a wreck she had last year. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time. She didn't choose to be there. There was nothing inherently bad in the decision she made to go out and do whatever she did that morning and come back home. She just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. There are other people who find themselves in the right place at the right time. They didn't necessarily plan. They didn't use some great skill or wisdom to put themselves in a position to be to benefit by something that was going on. But that does happen. Yes, time and chance happens. But it's not the dominant force in this life. There are those who believe that everything that happens to us is just by chance. It's just by luck. I remember Lisa, she likes to talk about a situation where you've got someone, they're not in a great marriage. And they would look at somebody who has a happy marriage, not perfect, but happy. Husband's doing what he's supposed to be doing most of the time. The wife's doing what she's... And this person in the bad marriage will look over there and see that and say, you're so lucky to have a husband like that. You're so lucky to have that marriage. Like, no, it's not luck. Luck has nothing to do with it. It's about effort. It's about actually trying to make a marriage what it should be. It is not luck. But that is the attitude and idea a lot of people have. That they see the man over here prospering. Oh, he's so lucky. The guy's suffering. Oh, he's a poor fellow. He's just never gotten a good opportunity in life. As I said, sometimes, yes, time and chance do happen, but the most of the things we find ourselves involved with, the good or the bad, it's a result of the choices we make. And I think we see that as we come on down. In verse 12, he says, "For man also does not know his time, like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them." And so what people would say, you were just like, that fish is swimming along and he hadn't done anything good or bad and he just caught up in the net. That bird's caught in the snare. And just that's the way it is with us. We either have good luck or bad luck. But notice as we keep reading here, "This wisdom I have also seen under the sun. It seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it and built great snares around it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city, yet no one remembered that same poor man. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised. His words are not heard. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." So we have this example here given of a city that's saved, not by might, not by power, but by the wisdom of this poor man. Now he speaks of how this man was forgotten, how there were many who didn't recognize what truly saved the city. But it doesn't change the fact that the city was saved not by luck, but by this man's wisdom. It didn't just happen out that the city was saved. The wisdom saved the city. As you come on down in chapter 10, verse 1, "Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor." The value of a good name, I think, is impressed upon most people from the time they're very young. You're born into a family that has a good name. You need to uphold that name. You need to live your life in such a way as to have that name be respected. But what does it take for that name to be despised? What does it take to ruin that name? Well, just a little folly, one moment, an instant. But not an instant of luck, not an instant of just time and chance, but an instance of making a foolish decision by a choice that we make. That's how that name is ruined. That's how that thing that once may have been a good odor, now it is so foul to some. It wasn't time and chance that made that happen. In verse 2, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks wisdom, and he shows everyone that he's a fool. If the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post, for conciliation pacifies great offenses. What he says there in verses 2 and 3, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, even when but a fool's heart is at his left. We find in the scriptures often that right hand and left hand is used to describe a division. When Jesus talks about the return, his return, and how the sheep will be gathered on the right hand, the goats on the left, and we know their fate. The same type of division is being talked about here. But this division is more than just skin deep. It's not just, well, you just got picked to be over here, you got picked to be over there. You see that it's his heart that's at the core of where he is, either on the right or the left. And notice in verse 3, when a fool walks along the way, he shows everyone that he's a fool. It's what he's doing. It's the life that he's living that shows that he's a fool. He didn't just, you know, fall on bad luck. He's not just one that was picked out of a lineup and chosen to meet his fate. It's because of the choices he makes. Verse 5, there's an evil that I have seen under the sun as an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity while the rich sit in a lowly place. I've seen servants on horses while princes walk on the ground like servants. I think the idea is just there are some things that you'll see in this life that don't look like they belong. You'll find people who you would expect to be in a lowly place, they'll be in a high place. People who seem like they should be in a high place, they would be in the low place. And again, maybe time and chance brought some of that about, but most often people are where they are because of the choices that they make. And I think we'll see that even more clearly as we come on down. Look in verse 8. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. If the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. But wisdom brings success. I don't know if you can read verse 8 without thinking about a man like Haman. One who dug a pit for Mordecai. He didn't literally dig a pit, he built a gallows. But the idea was he's going to set a scheme in motion to bring about the ruin and the death of Mordecai. But what happened to him? He was hung on those gallows. He dug the pit and he fell into it. Whoever breaks through a wall. You know, someone, I don't know if this is exactly the idea, but I think it follows what we've been talking about. You know, somebody decides, you know, I want what's in that house over there. This wall here is not going to stand in my way. So they're going to climb over the wall. They're going to try to break through the wall. And then they get hurt in the process and they think, oh, that's just bad luck. It wasn't bad luck. You made the decision to try to climb over that wall. I've heard of lawsuits that criminals have brought against the people they were trying to victimize. And they're upset because they fell into some trouble on the way. Well, whose fault was that? Well, obviously they think it's the person they're victimizing's fault. Well, it's their fault. They're the one that chose that course of action. And I think that's what we're seeing there in verses 8 and 9. And verse 10 shows us that, you know, if you just put a little thought into something. I remember it may have been Travis who taught the lesson several years ago about two men in this race, you know, and cutting the wood, and the one man kept sitting down, and the other guy thought, well, I've got this made. You know, he keeps taking a break. Well, he ends up getting beat, and what he finds out is the man wasn't just sitting down to take a break. He was sharpening his axe. He was using wisdom. He was understanding that if I just keep beating this piece of wood with a blunt end of an axe, I'm not going to accomplish anything. But if you actually use some wisdom, you'll bring success. Which goes back to the idea, it's not just time and chance. Use wisdom. Use the God-given gifts that He's made available to us to better your situation in life. To take hold of your future. The future is not just in the hands of time and chance, but we can control our destiny and which way we will go. Verse 11, a serpent may bite when it's not charmed. The babbler is no different. So you've got a man who has the skill of charming the snake, but if he doesn't use that skill, he's going to get bit. And he's no better than the Bible. No one who had no idea of how to charm the snake. Use what we have. Verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his talk is raving madness. A fool also multiplies words. No man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will be after him? The labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city. I don't think there's much commentary needed on that section. Just the foolish people, those who will not use wisdom, those who don't use the gifts that God has given them. Well, they will end up in a place that they might say, well, I just don't even know how I got there. Well, I can tell you how they got there. They were foolish. They didn't try to do any better. I would love to go through just verse by verse, but we're going to have to skip down and cover some of this. Let's go on to chapter 11, verse 1. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a serving to seven and also to eight, for you do not know what evil will be on the earth. Here, I think these verses are pretty easy to understand. Earlier in the book, I think we see some teachings about the value of money, what money can do for us in this life. And I think we are to value money, but don't hoard it. Don't just heap it up for ourselves. And I think that's what we see here in verse 1. Cast your bread upon the waters. Maybe there's the idea of benevolence here. Maybe it's just the idea of just using what God has given us. Maybe we don't know exactly where it's going, but disperse it. Send it to others. You will find it after many days. This isn't the health and wealth gospel preached by some. If you will, you know, give this seed to God, then He's going to bless you so much in return. But it is what He's saying. The blessings may not come back in the form of money. It's not that we're going to give $1,000 and say we're going to receive $2,000 in return. But be guaranteed that if you use the blessings that God has given, then He will bless us in return. Verse 2, when He says, give a serving to seven, also to eight. That seven represents completeness. Maybe we think, well, here's enough. I've done enough. And what I think he's saying here is, do more than enough. Go over that. You remember when Peter asked Jesus, how often shall I forgive my brother? Up to seven times. And what did Jesus say? No, up to 70 times seven. And so, you know, when you've done good and when you've dispersed that bread on the waters and you've done it in what you would consider to be enough, well, then do some more. Keep giving. Keep serving. Verse 3, if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. That's what clouds are. They're rain. They don't gather the moisture just to keep being a cloud. They gather moisture to give it. That's the way we ought to be as Christians. We gather the blessings from God in order to be a blessing. Isn't that what God told Abraham in Genesis chapter 3? I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. Let's use the blessings that God has given us while there is time. He says there at the end of verse 3, if a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it shall lie. And when it lies there, it's not going to move anymore. It can't do anything else. It's done. There's coming a time in our life when we're going to be like that tree. We fall. We're done. We're dead. What are you going to do then? You can't do anything. So use the time you have now. Use the blessings you have now to accomplish something while you still can. Verse 4, he observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. So we want to use the blessing. We want to be a blessing, but we want the perfect opportunity. We want the perfect situation. And I think what he's saying here is you're not going to get it. You know, we're going to sow. Oh, the wind's up a little bit. You know, it's not the perfect day to sow. It's not the perfect day to reap. But if you're waiting for the perfect day, you'll never do anything. And so don't be foolish. You know, we're not going to just go out and squander what the Lord has blessed us with. But don't be waiting for that perfect time. Just find a time to go and to do as we should. Verse 5, as you do not know what is the way of the wind or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with a child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything. And I think that's a reminder that we need. We've learned a lot. You know, you can open up a science book or a biology book. You can learn a lot about the growth of a child in the mother's womb. And we know a lot about that, but we don't know everything, certainly. There's a lot we don't know, and there's a lot we'll never know. And we certainly will not know the works of God, but we don't have to. We don't have to know everything. And I think that goes back to the idea of looking for that perfect situation, that perfect scenario. We'll never know exactly when that is. So what do we do in the meantime? We work. And we serve God. In verse 6, in the morning sow your seed, in the evening do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which shall prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. I think there's two ways we might could take verse 6, in the morning sow your seed, in the evening do not withhold your hand. It may just have the idea of, again, not knowing that perfect time, not knowing which is going to be better, the morning or the evening. He says both might be good. He may be talking about even a single day, but I think he also, as we go on into chapter 12, he could be talking about this idea of just the stages of our life, in the morning, in our youth, and then in the evening, and you know, later in our years. And I think both would fit there. But I think the idea just still comes back to use the opportunities you have right now. You get older and you think about all the times we wasted, we squandered the opportunities we have. Well, we could sit around and bemoan that, or we could get busy doing what we can now. We could sit in our youth and think, well, I've still got a lot of time ahead of me. There are more opportunities going to come. You don't know that. Use the time you have now. You know, both may prosper, but only if we actually do something with the time. Verse 7, truly the light is sweet and it's pleasant to the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man live many years and rejoices in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. All that is coming is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Therefore remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come and the years draw near, when you say, I have no pleasure in them. Young people, remember these verses. There are three R's here. Rejoice, remove, and remember. Rejoice in the days of your youth. God gave us youth to be enjoyed, to do something with it. But know that God is going to judge you for that rejoicing. There are good ways you can rejoice and there are evil ways you can rejoice. If we know that God is going to judge us, then that's going to help us rejoice in the right ways. And so knowing that God will bring you into judgment, remove, or verse 10, remove sorrow from your heart. Put evil away from you. Choose the good. Choose to do what is right. Choose to rejoice in the things that God would rejoice in. And remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come. I think this may go back to that idea of using what we have while we can. Back in chapter 9, we're talking about living joyfully with the wife whom you have all the days of your vain life. You know, there are some things that we will not be able to enjoy in the life to come. The same is true even in this life. There's coming a day when you will not be able to do. You will not be able to enjoy the things that you can enjoy now. There are decisions you're going to make in your youth that will affect your older years. You think about what I was talking about earlier. Somebody would look and say, you're so lucky that you found that good woman. You're so lucky that you found that good man. Luck's not going to, if you wait for luck, you're not going to have a happy home. Use wisdom. Choose a good mate. Choose one that's going to help you to serve God. When you think about the choice of a husband or wife, if you think about using wisdom in your youth, use that in bringing up your children. We've got a number of younger people, I put myself in that category, younger, we still have children. We're still teaching. We're still training. Use the time you have right now to do that. There's coming a day they're not going to listen to you. Maybe they will. Hopefully that we can still have some kind of an impact, but not like we can now. So use the time you have now. You know, I think there are a lot of parents who their kids grow up and they're one way or the other, and they have that idea, well, it's just time and chance. You know, some kids are just going to turn out good. Some kids are just turn. You know, some kids just have that rebellious attitude, and some are sweet. And I'm not saying that there aren't different personalities. You know, we've got five kids. We see different personalities in those kids. But it certainly is not time and chance that determines whether or not they're going to serve the Lord. We have a say in that. You know, I think there are a lot of people who have this ungodly view of just, well, it doesn't matter what we do. It's all vanity. You know, you try to teach your kids, we bring them to church every Sunday, and well, they just run off, they don't care about God. Now, is it true that kids have free will and that children can choose to serve the Lord regardless of what we do? Yes, that's true. But what the book of Proverbs tells us is if we train up that child, bring him up in the way he should go. When he's old, he's not to depart from it. But we have to use the time we have now to the very best of our ability. You know, we think about the lack of elders in the church. When I was in Kenya, that was one of the lessons I taught. I asked, within a 50, they use kilometers over there, within a 50-kilometer radius of where we are right here, how many churches would you say have elders? It didn't take anybody long to answer that question. None of them. None of them have elders. Now, we're not talking about churches that have only been established for a few years. There are some new congregations, but there are some that have been there for 30 years, but yet they still don't have elders. And they kind of hung their heads, and I don't think rightfully so, but I told them, you know, don't feel so bad. It's not like you're just the wickedest people in the world, because in America, we face the same problem. You know, why don't we have elders in so many churches in America? I think it's because of this. Because we didn't remember our Creator in the days of our youth. Because when we were young and our children were young, we were so busy with the things of this world and making sure that they had all that this world has to offer that we didn't give any thought to God. And then there comes the days when we can't change that. We can't change the seed we've sown. So I think what he's saying there at the beginning of chapter 12 is use the time you have right now to do the most with it. Because there's coming a day, in verse 2, when the sun, the light, the moon, the stars are darkened, and the clouds do return after the rain. I know I'm reading this a little differently than the way it's written. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men bow down, when the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows grow dim. When the doors are shut in the streets and the sound of grinding is low, when one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of music are brought low. Also they are afraid of height and terrors in the way. When the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper is a burden and desire fails. For man goes to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. For a long time, I read through those verses. I didn't have a clue what he's talking about. The older I get, I begin to understand a little bit more. You know, verse 2, he talks about the light is dimmer. You know, as you get older, that light begins to dim. And there comes a time when there really is no sunshine. There's no day when you're going to wake up and just think, oh, this is a glorious day. Because there are a lot of pains and there are a lot of aches and there are a lot of burdens. In verse 3, the day when the keepers of the house tremble. It's hard to know exactly with each of these. You know, maybe he's talking about the hands, the arms. I have a friend up in Georgia that for as long as I've known him, he just trembles. He can't even write his name because he shakes so much. Maybe that's what he's talking about. The strong men bow down and the grinders cease. Maybe our legs are weakened. The grinders, maybe he's talking about the teeth or the lack thereof. Those that look through the windows grow dim, talking about our eyes possibly. When the doors are shut in the streets. The sound of grinding is low. We can't hear like we once were. But you kind of get the point. He's talking about the body and how as we grow older, things stop working. And so again, be reminded that use what you have while you have it. He comes back in verse 6 to the same thing. Remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher shattered at the fountain. You know, that silver cord, that golden bowl, the pitcher. You know, these are precious things, and there's coming a day when those precious things will be lost or broken. In verse 7, the dust will return to earth as it was. The spirit will return to God who gave it. And then I would just like to insert these words before verse 8. If we haven't found God, after all of this, when our life is coming to an end, if we haven't found God, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. But you come down to verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. And you think about that statement as opposed to verse 8. And you see that that will have made all the difference in our life. If we fear God and keep His commandments, knowing that God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil, then we will have hope. But we have to continue to look through that godly lens, that view that God is here. He is before. We are before Him. He sees what we do. And He will judge what we do. And so our life is not just a series of happenings, you know, time and chance. Use the wisdom that God has given us to be that lion. To be the one who, yeah, the world might look at and say, well, he's dead now. What good has all of his labors done? Well, they will never really see that good. But we will. Yeah, we'll experience it for eternity. Jesus, the great lion, the lion of the tribe of Judah, has prevailed. And he gives us the opportunity to follow him. But we can only do so if we keep God in view, if we remember him, if we remove our feet from evil. And if we do that, we can rejoice in this life. We can rejoice in the blessings that he's given us. But there are those who will continue to suffer, who will continue to mourn, who will continue to see this life as just a worthless existence. Don't let that be you. Have the joy that God intends for us to have. Be blessed in this life, knowing that we have something far greater awaiting us. We have hope, a hope that so many in this world do not have. I appreciate everyone's attention tonight, and I encourage you to continue to look to God, not just in the book of Ecclesiastes, but throughout your life. Look to God. Know that the choices that we make, that will determine our future. And don't leave it to chance. If we leave it to chance, I can tell you where that destiny will be. So if there's any way we can help you tonight, if you need help in your life, in your walk with God, we would love to be able to help you, to study more with you, to help you on your walk, in your walk with God to that eternal end where we can have that wonderful everlasting home with our God. If we can help you in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?